Thank you, Carissa. It's exciting to see so many people here helping to rip out all of our carpet here. For 10 years that I've been here, I've been excited to get rid of this carpet. And we're going to rip this out. We're going to rip out the lobby. We're going to rip out the hallways. It's all going out. So God is good. My name is Josh Carson. I'm the lead pastor here. My wife and I fell in love in the summer of 2002. She will disagree with that. She will say that we fell in love in the spring of 2003, because apparently in 2002 that she had a boyfriend. But we went to summer camp together, and I fell in love with her from a distance. But that summer camp romance really started a great friendship that eventually during the spring of 2003, we really did fall in love. And that was the end of our senior year of high school. Went to prom together, did the whole summer dating in love thing, which was super fun. And then for the next 2 years, God graced us with being able to go to school really close to one another. She went to UC San Diego in San Diego, and I went to Biola University in Los Angeles, about 100 miles apart from one another. And it was the perfect setup you could ever ask for. And this was all pre-us knowing one another in this context. God kind of ordained this, I would say. My best friend on the planet went to school with her, and her cousin went to school with me. And so every possible weekend, we spent time with one another. Every free moment, whether it was like, let's meet in San Clemente in the middle on a Wednesday night or every weekend, it was hot and heavy. It was love. It was strong. It was amazing. It still is. Thank you, someone. Come on. I'm throwing my soul out here. Someone. Yeah. So after 2 years, I was about to graduate the next year, and I knew that I was either going to stay in Southern California or leave to go to seminary and grad school, and so I wanted to take the best friend of my life with me, and so I asked her to marry me in the summer of 2005. She said yes, thank God, and we set a date for June 2006 to get married, and so we had a whole year to prepare and to plan for this wedding. Right, and if you've ever prepared or planned for a wedding, you know that there's a lot of work. There's a lot of preparation. My wife comes from a split family, and so we had to talk to the dad and we had to talk to the mom. Okay, what's a budget look like? And so we get some numbers. And being 20, we had a lot to bring to the table. So we kind of got that number and figured out. Okay, here's our parameters and how we're going to plan for this thing. And so you got to find a venue, and you got to find a dress, and you got to find a caterer, and you got to find an MC, and you got to find all these different things. You got to figure out the guest list. Right? And that's hard. When you're young, when you get married young, you still have a lot of friends. And so all your family still kind of likes you at this point. And so trying to figure out, wow, how are we going to figure out to how can we get all these people inside of this building? So you kind of work through it and you figure out this guest list. And it's a lot of work, particularly for the groom, right? Right? You laugh. Come on, someone. For us really engaged, helpful grooms, now, obviously, in our culture, the bride typically takes on a lot of that load. Not always, but kind of in our culture, that's common. And that was true in my house as well. And so we planned, we prepared. And it is not an understatement to say that in our lives, this was by far the single biggest planned event in our life. Like, by a long shot. I can't even think of anything else except maybe preparing for a child. But as far as an event goes, like, you spend far more time preparing for your wedding day than really anything else in life. And this is true in our time, and it certainly was true a few thousand years ago. And so we're going to see today why Jesus does his first public miracle in this setting. It was not a mistake. It was not an accident. It was crucial. Jesus had something to say in communicating to the world who he was through a party at a wedding. So we're going to open it up. We're going to open up with Jesus' first miracle. We're going to go John chapter 2. If you're wondering why we're starting a John series in John chapter 2, it's because in December and early January, we already kind of plowed through John 1, but we cheated and used some of that for Christmas. So I'm going to ask that you would stand, and we'll go John chapter 2, starting in verse 1. And I'm reading from the English Standard Version. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You can take a seat. At the very end of the book of John, in chapter 20, John does something that not all biblical writers do. He tells us exactly why he writes the book. If you were to go to verse 30, I believe, verse 30 of John chapter 20, we read this. It says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." So at the very end of his writing, John says, here's why I'm writing this book. I'm going to put all some effort and energy into explaining a very few particular miracles that Jesus does. I'm going to give you his life. I'm going to spend half of this book in 1 week of his life. But all of these signs are all for one reason. They are all so that you will know that Jesus is Messiah and that by believing you will have life in his name. Right, we've been talking this whole year about this whole idea of live, of defining what it means to live. And so John makes it very clear, if you want true life, if you want to truly live, you've got to know this Jesus character. And so what I love about how he introduces Jesus to all of us in terms of his first miracle is he gets to the heart of what Jesus is all about. He gets to the heart of Jesus is for us in our greatest moments of effort, and he takes our shame and he gives us his honor. And so we're going to kind of work through this story. It's a little bit different than how I was originally planning to a number of months ago. But we're going to work through the story and see why Jesus starts with a wedding. You know, when I was younger, I always kind of wanted to know, like, why water to wine? Why a wedding? It seems kind of arbitrary. Why is this the culmination of his introduction to the world? Right? I mean, you're younger and you think, well, it's a great way to gather a bunch of friends. You show up to a party with 6 kegs and a lot of people are going to start following you. And that's, you know, that's kind of like the 16-year-old version of me thinking about this passage. But it's actually far, far deeper than that. Jesus does something profound here at this wedding. So you think about a wedding in ancient times, and in ancient times, it was kind of like us in terms of a lot of people spend a huge amount of effort preparing and planning for a wedding. See, in ancient times, when people would get married, you'd have 2 different families coming together. You'd have the bride's family and the groom's family, and they would arrange marriages most of the time. And this would be a deal that would be made between the dads, and the dads would say, okay, here's what we want to see. And ultimately, all of the pressure came down to the groom. So they had a year-long period. This would have been called the betrothal period. You might remember someone named Mary and Joseph in this period being called betrothal. They weren't married yet, but they were engaged to one another. The marriage hasn't been consummated yet. They're not living together yet. But the groom had a year to prepare for his wife, right? And in this preparation, this is what it looked like. The groom had to find a good job. Right? Not only did he have to find a good job, but he had to prepare a house. He had to either go buy a house or he had to build a house. Very often he would build a house on his parents' land. And I kind of like that strategy these days. I kind of wish that was still a thing. But ultimately, the groom had to show the wife's family that he was going to provide for his future spouse. And it was also his full responsibility to prepare, to plan the wedding. So the groom would get the venue. The groom would get the pastor, he'd get the DJ, he'd get the bartender, he would figure out the caterer, he would do everything. It was completely up to him to show to the wife's family that he was going to be a provider, a protector, and that he was a competent groom. After a year, after all this preparation was done, the groom would take an entourage with him, namely his family, his closest friends, and some of the bridal party, and they would march to the bride's house. And they would knock on the door and they would tell her, "Everything is ready for our life. I have spent the last year of my life preparing for this moment, preparing to be a competent husband, and I want you to come with me. And as you come with me, we are going to go to this wedding, the celebration. It's going to last a week, but it is a display to our community that I am a worthy spouse. And most importantly, it's a display to your father and your mother that I can take care of you. And what do we see in this story? The groom goes and he gets his wife, his soon-to-be bride, and he brings her back to the party, and the party is going, and everything seems well at first. And you know, they've got the tuxes and they've got the dresses and whatever they did in terms of their look, and the music was there, and the food was there, and the dancing was there, but eventually something happens. Eventually the groom fails, and the wine runs out. And we think about it, and as we think about it, we think, oh, well, that doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. Someone just run to Safeway and get a couple of boxes of wine, we'll be just fine. But that was not the context back then. Ultimately, what was happening in this moment is the deepest level of shame and embarrassment. Because what this said is, hey, you spent a year planning and preparing for something, and you didn't think through all the details. Right, this would have been a very small village. Canaan was a small village, perhaps a few hundred people. Everyone that they knew and loved was there. This would have been all their family members, all their friends, all their neighbors, all their fellow community members at this wedding. And in the highlight of this man's life, where he spent a year preparing for it, everyone's looking at him going, you failed. And everyone's wondering, do you have what it takes to take care of your soon-to-be bride? And it's in this moment that Jesus does an incredible miracle. This shame would have been so significant that theologian D.A. Carson says that he would have potentially even been liable to lawsuit from the wife's family because of the disgrace that would have been brought to her family. I mean, imagine, like, what, as I was thinking through, like, what this would have been like for us in our context, what would that be like? And I get to do a lot of weddings. That's one of the fun things about being a pastor. You get to do a lot of weddings, and weddings are a ton of fun. So it's very often I get to stand up here, and there's a great young bride and groom, and we get to kind of talk through marriage, and we get to have the ceremony. But I want you to imagine if in that moment, instead of me saying, okay, 1 Corinthians 13, love, and here's some doves and some sand and some candles. Like, imagine if in that moment you've got everyone around, and I'm up here, and I say, hey, before we get going, I just want all of you guys to know that this groom, I don't think he's going to be a good husband. Yeah, I don't think he has what it takes. Have you kind of watched his history? Like, he's failed in every school that he's ever tried. Business, absolute failure. Like, I don't know that this is really going to work out. Like, we can sit there and we can say that would never in 1,000 years happen at a wedding, right? And if that happened, that would be brutal in front of your entire community, all of your friends, all of your family. And from everything that I read, that is the exact same equivalent of the shame and guilt and discouragement that it would have been for this groom to have spent a year planning for something and to have it not work out. So what happens next? We pick it up in verse 3. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, there's a lot of debate here about both the intention of Mary and the response of Jesus, right? Was Mary coming to Jesus demanding? Was she insisting? Was she saying, hey, I know who you are. Someone told me there was that whole virgin birth thing. I know that you're God. You can do something here. Was that what was happening? I don't know. What was Jesus doing when he says, woman, my hour has not yet come? Is Jesus mad? Like, some people read that and they believe, like, no, Jesus is kind of upset here. Or some people believe that kind of that language of, like, woman is kind of that more tender, like when Jesus in John 19 is on the cross and he says the same word, woman, behold your son. Some people see it that way, but ultimately what I see is two different things going on here. We see both the divinity and the humanity of Jesus in this moment. You see in his divinity the fact that he is God, that he knows why he came. So he says, the hour has not yet come. 5 times in the book of John, Jesus uses the phrase the hour, referring to the moment where he is about to be killed. So Jesus knows he came to earth for a very particular reason, right? Not only to display what it looks like to be a God follower, a God fearer on earth, but he came to die in place of you and I. right? And so he knows what's coming. He knows where he's about to head to. So in his divinity, he looks ahead and he knows, okay, this is about to happen. But in his humanity, he's also a bit scared right now. Because what's about to happen? This is the first time that he's about to unveil the curtain and show the world who he is. And that means the timer's started. He knows that that once this happens, the story will start to move towards the cross. Because for 30 years up to this point, he's been a great neighborhood friend. You know, he's been just kind of your average person that no one's thinking anything about. There's been no controversy so far in his life. So far in his life, everything that he's done has been under the radar. He hasn't done any miracles yet. But he knows that the minute that he does this next miracle, the timer will begin. And so he sees in his fear this moment where, okay, the cross is coming, and I've been waiting 30 years for this moment, and it's about to begin. But he takes his human fear, and he pushes past his humanity, and he pushes towards his divinity. And he says, fill the jars with water. Man, we learn in verse 6 about these jars. A lot of pastors talk a lot about this, and this is kind of one of the main pieces that a lot of people talk about in terms of this miracle. We're going to talk just briefly about the significance of these jars and what was going on here. So there are 6 kind of large stone jars. These would have been used for what is called in this text the Jewish rites of purification. All right, so if we were to go back to ancient history, in the early Jewish world, God gives his people a number of different laws and regulations of how to love him, how to follow him, how to be effective in life. But the Jewish people start adding to these. They start adding all these extra rules, all these extra things that they can do to make themselves feel right before God. And one of these extra things that they would do is all these practices of washing themselves. And it wasn't to get clean from the dirt on their hands, but it was essentially to represent that they were clean before God in their hearts. And so before religious ceremonies, particularly before a ceremony like a wedding, they would have these jars and there would be a little ceremony where they would wash themselves to represent that their hearts were clean. But the problem with that is that any time we put ourselves in a place where we think that anything physical that we can do that will clean our hearts is we put ourselves in a place where we're lying to ourselves. Where we're lying to ourselves saying that what we need is a physical action because what we need is a new heart. Right? And Jesus is so clear about the hypocrisy of people thinking that they can earn God's favor and his love through these ritual acts. Right, we see this super clear in Mark chapter 7. Jesus says this when some people were asking him, well, why don't your people wash like everyone else washes? And Jesus says this in verse 6. He says, well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. You leave the commandment of God and hold to the traditions of men. Man, the warning for you and I is it can be super easy to go through kind of practices in life, physical things that we do that make ourselves feel like we're right before God. Right? That might be showing up this morning. It might be treating your spouse a certain way. It might be reading something or listening to something or even singing a certain way where we go through these religious activities to make ourselves feel right before God. And ultimately, Jesus is saying, I don't want your religious activity. I don't just want you to go through the motions. Right? What I want is your heart. I don't just want you to come in here and go through the motions, but your heart be far from me. I need your heart. And ultimately, that was happening at this wedding, is you've got a bunch of people coming, filling these jars with water, cleaning themselves, trying to make their hearts ready. But Jesus says, you need me. You don't need this useless water. He says, fill the jars with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine and did not know where it came from, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now. Right in this moment where the groom was about to be shamed in front of everyone, we have an incredible reversal going on. right? We have the moment where everyone is about to say, you can't provide for your wife, where your in-laws now hate you, where now you are a public embarrassment and a public shame. We have the exact opposite happening. We have the MC, the master of the ceremony, coming to the groom saying, holy schmoly, you have prepared well. Right? You've got the job, you've got the house, the party has been going really, really well. Like, the pastor had a great message, the food has been great, the toasts were meaningful. And not only that, but we're a few days in and you bring out the best wine. You've done something that no one else does. My goodness, you are going to provide for your spouse. You are an incredible husband. Why would Jesus start his public ministry at a wedding? And why water to wine? Why is that a sign? Like I said earlier, in a wedding, no one tries harder. For this groom, it would have been the culmination of his greatest efforts. And in his greatest effort, he fails. And he fails in a way that should have brought incredible shame, incredible embarrassment to his family. But God meets us in our shame, and he meets us in our embarrassment, and he says, I give you my honor, and I put you in a place where everyone will see you actually have what it takes because you've got this gift from me. So why the wine? Right? And this is where I wanted to spend a whole lot more time on this section because I think it's really fun, but life went in a different direction, and we're going to share a few other things at the end of service, but why wine, right? If you look at most parties in our world, like, the wine, alcohol is a part of celebration. It just is. It certainly was a part of celebration in ancient Israel. You look at throughout the Old Testament, when it comes to wine, it's used to mark joy, to mark abundance, to mark overflow, to mark the good life. Right, wine is used as this culmination of epic celebration. And so Jesus is all about bringing the best wine, the good wine. There's an old rabbinic saying in Jewish world that says, when the wine runs out, the party is over. Right, so Jesus brings the best wine. And why wine? For a number of reasons, it's incredibly significant in this moment throughout history, but it's also a symbol of what's to come. Right, because 3 years later, Jesus is about to hold wine the night before he's arrested. He's about to hold this cup and he's going to say, this is my blood poured out for the sins of many. So he's about to say, hey, I'm going to give you my life. It's going to be the best human life possible. To live with me is to live a life of joy, to live a life of abundance, but it costs something great. It's going to cost me pouring my blood to give you this life. I think it's good just briefly to talk real quick about wine and alcohol briefly. Yes, alcohol is a gift from God, but it can be abused. And so as Christians, we want to be wise in how we use this gift, right? The Bible clearly teaches do not get drunk, but be filled with the Spirit. We know that. That is so clear. But certainly there are occasions where wine and alcohol are a gift from the Lord. But be wise, be careful. I would love to say so much more about that, but for right now, we're just going to keep blazing. Jesus gives us his life, and in his life, we get the fullness of joy, we're told. Man, so why a wedding? Where are we in this story? I think we're all in kind of different places if we think through kind of who we are in this story. I think it's good to think it through. I think for some of us, the most important thing that we need to realize is that you have run out of wine. Right, all of us at some point, we have to realize that in our greatest efforts in our life, right, our greatest efforts to prove to the world that we're good, that we're right, that we are good people, that ultimately we have failed in that. Have you recognized in your life that you have run out? I think it's interesting too, because he goes for a while. It's not like the first thing that happens. This wedding's been going on for a little while. Right? You know, it may be day two, it may be day four, five, but things seem to be going well for a while. And sometimes in life, like, we feel like we've got it taken care of, but eventually, and I know this far too well from talking to so many people, you can try to live your life, but eventually, you're going to get to the point where you're saying, you know what, I'm not satisfied with what I'm trying to do. Something feels missing. Have you recognized that you've run out of wine? Next, will you fully accept the gift from Jesus? Right, there has to be this moment in this groom's life where he has to accept that this isn't something that he did. Right, you got to accept that. Like he has to make this choice of, okay, like I didn't plan for this. Like I don't know what was happening here, but thank you. Like the groom has to have a thank you moment there. He has, if he's going to be honored in front of everyone, he has to accept that gift. Have you accepted the gift of Jesus in your life? Maybe you're like the disciples in this moment, where you've heard the claims of Jesus. You go back to John chapter 1, and Jesus already claims that he's the Son of Man. Maybe you've heard all these claims, but maybe what you need is you need to see something in your life, right? So the disciples, they had to follow Jesus for a while. They had to follow him long enough to be able to see this miracle. They could have said, you know what, I've heard your claims. I heard the things that you're about. I heard you from John chapter 1, but I'm not going to follow you enough to get into your life to where I can see this miracle take place. Have you heard the claims of Jesus, but need to see the miracle? How do we do that? You got to hang around Jesus. What does that look like? Are we in the Word? Are we committed to a church? Are we practicing the disciplines? Are we in community with other Christians? Are we serving regularly? When we are committed to being with Jesus through those things, we will have an opportunity to see some of the signs that Jesus does in giving us his life. Maybe in the story you're like Mary, right? What does Mary do? I love the fact that Mary, she recognizes the embarrassment that's about to happen. Maybe you've been following Jesus for a long time in your life, and the challenge for you is find out where other people need Jesus, right? And figure out wisely and gently and graciously how to tell people about the one who turns water into the one who gives you the best life possible. So if you're in a season where you're Mary and there's other people around you and you're recognizing that they have a need for something great, or they are about to face public shame and embarrassment or a life without meaning eventually, maybe your call is to help people see that they need Jesus. It wasn't a mistake that the first miracle, the first sign in the life of Jesus was to say, in your biggest efforts, you will fail before me. But in the greatest gift that I can give you, I'm going to pour out my life for you. I'm going to give you my blood. I'm going to give you the best wine. And I'm going to give you my honor. I'm going to give you my glory. And you will have a place where your shame is gone. And you will be with me, the best human life possible. We're going to wrap it up and we're going to pray and we're going to ask God, God, would you show us that you are the true master of ceremonies? That Jesus, you give us the best life, you give us the best wine, and let us not substitute it with anything but this gift from you. Father God, I thank you for this gift. God, I thank you that as we think through our lives and we think through the effort that we put into our lives, very often we are trying to prove ourselves to you. We're trying to prove ourselves to the world that I'm a worthy spouse, I'm a worthy groom, I'm worthy before you, Jesus. But in all of our best efforts, we will always fall short. So I pray that we would recognize that this morning. I pray that we would recognize that we will all run out and that we need to accept what you give us. God, I pray for those here this morning who have heard some of the claims of you, but they haven't seen for themselves. I love at the end, I think it's verse 11 where it says, the disciples saw and they believed. God, if there's people here who need to see, I pray that they would put themselves in a place following you, Jesus, to where that they would see that you are good, that you offer the best life. And Lord, for those of us in here who have been following you for a season, I pray that we would be like Mary, that our eyes would be up, that we'd be looking and seeing where are the moments of shame that are about to happen? Where are the people who need to hear from you? Where are the people who need to know that you give us your life? And I pray that in boldness, in generosity, Lord, that we would share our hearts, that people need you. Lord, I thank you that you've given us your honor for our shame. We love you and we pray these things in your name. Amen.